This is Can I Laugh on Your Shoulder? Hey, welcome to Can I Laugh on Your Shoulder? I'm Molly Stillman, and this is a podcast where each week I get to sit down with a different guest and have raw, funny, often brutally honest conversations about the things that matter most. Faith, business, life, and everything in between, where we each learned how to be good stewards of the things we've been entrusted with, even our stories, and how we can use those things to serve others and leave our families, our friendships, and our communities a little better than we found them. I want to create a space where people are unafraid to be themselves and unafraid to ask the questions the rest of us are thinking. My goal is to make you laugh, cry, and laugh till you cry. My guest this week is Melissa Krueger, who serves as the Vice President of Discipleship Programming at the Gospel Coalition. She regularly teaches women in her community and speaks at conferences around the country. Her latest book is titled Parenting with Hope: Raising Teens for Christ in a Secular Age. This conversation is so important for anyone who is parenting, but especially those of us who have influence over kids. So whether you're a coach or a teacher or whatever it is, if you have influence on kids, this conversation is so important. We're talking about how kids transition into new stages of life. Parents change as well. We're talking about kids having overly committed schedules. We're talking about how prayer helps kids navigate the world. And man, there's just so many things that we get into in this conversation. I know you're going to walk away with something just really impactful. So I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. So without further ado, on to my chat with Melissa Krueger. I already know that this is going to be a fantastic episode because Melissa and I have been talking for 15 minutes and I realized that we weren't even recording and it sounded like we were just having the conversation of a lifetime. So Melissa, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is such a joy. Immediately we connected because apparently you used to live like right where I live, like old stomping grounds. You went to Carolina, so you root for the right color blue. We were both high school English teachers. Like, we both love dogs. We both love memoirs. It's a whole thing. So this is just already, I'm so excited about this conversation. So let's have you just go ahead and give us the Melissa 101. So tell us who you are, what you do, and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, well, my name is Melissa. I am currently serving as the Vice President for the Gospel Coalition, which is a website and a lot of other things. We have a big conference, and I work in discipleship programming, and that's what I do now. I have three great kids. I have a 23-year-old, a 20-year-old, and a 17-year-old, and I'm married to Mike, who is president of Reformed Theological Seminary. And, you know, how I got to where I am today, I always say is God's grace. It was not my plan, but somehow the Lord gets us where he wants us. And so that's what I always say. It is a very circuitous route through many different jobs and a variety of things. And somehow I have ended up writing books in this world. So it's a surprise to me.
I love it. I learned that this book that you are releasing, and by the time this airs, your book will already be out, but Parenting with Hope, Raising Teens for Christ in a Secular Age will already be out. And it's like your what, 16th book, something like that? Book number 16?
Yes. Which,
incredible.
I don't know how that happened. Yes.
Incredible.
Yes.
Well, as someone who is in the process of releasing book one, I'm tired. And so I am so... just congratulations, because that's a huge, huge accomplishment. Well, I love your story. So go back. Like I mentioned in the beginning, you were a high school English teacher, or not English, but you were a high school teacher at some point. And so tell us that story of like what led you from teaching to working in ministry and that bit of a, yeah, that circuitous route, I believe you said.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's even crazier, I was a high school math teacher. You're right to assume maybe I was an English teacher because I ended up working in editing.
I was an English teacher. So that's why my brain was like on that wiring.
Well, and it would make a lot of sense when you end up writing books, but somehow I went from math to writing. And it actually really started just because I taught for years, and my husband and I lived overseas while he was working his PhD, and I even taught over there. And then we had our first child, and I started staying home. And at that point, I started leading Bible studies in my community. And honestly, it was the time before there were 1,000 different Bible studies to do. Now there are so many good resources, but at the time there just weren't as many. And so I started writing Bible studies for my small group. I said, hey, I can just write up a few questions and we'll do them. And then women would miss, as women do. And so then I'd write up a summary explaining what they had missed. And it kind of just went from there. People kept saying, other churches would say, can I use your Bible study? I heard you wrote this whole study. And then as things go, they did. And my first book was released in 2012. It was actually on the topic of envy, and it was called The Envy of Eve. And it was from a Bible study I had done on the book of Joshua. And so that there were some themes I saw in there that overlapped, and I ended up writing there. And then I will say this, in those books, when you hear 16, you think trade books. Three of those books are children's books. And let me just say, they're a lot easier and more fun to write than trade books.
Hey, because a book is a book, Melissa. Yeah, no downplay. Yeah. No just saying just children's books. No. That is not allowed here.
Well, they're a lot easier. Let me say that. You know, they're like really, and they're so much fun because you get lovely pictures and all of these things. So, but yeah, I've always loved reading. I've always kept a journal since I was about 15. I've been writing out prayers to the Lord and just always writing. That was always a part of my life. I just didn't expect it to become my job.
I always love hearing people's backstories. I think that's part of why I even started a podcast, was I'm really just fascinated by people's stories, their origin stories. Like I love the Marvel movies where you get the origin story of the superhero, like, you know, I love that route of how you kind of almost stumbled into it accidentally. Well, so that kind of leads us into the conversation that for, you know, why I decided to have you on and so much of the heart behind your book. So obviously, you know, you work at the Gospel Coalition, but you've been, you know, in ministry for a while. And not only do you have experience with parenting teenagers, but also teaching teenagers. And one thing I love that you said before we hit record was how, you know, you kind of got practice with teenagers before you had teenagers of your own. And so this topic in particular, you know, so I'll tell you, my kids are 10 and 8. And so we are in the stage of, especially with my daughter, like we're in the tween age, and the tween age is just navigating the tween age is a whole different thing that I don't think I was really prepared for. It's amazing in some ways, and it is also incredibly hard in others. And then I, you know, so many of my friends are also in that same stage. But then, you know, a couple of my good friends, like their kids are graduating high school this year. And so it's navigating this stage of parenting. There's so many layered challenges. And, you know, I remember thinking back to like when I was raising, you know, when I had a newborn and a toddler, and it's like you're in the weeds and your kids can't do anything for themselves. And it's just like you're tired and you're touched out, and there's just all of it, all the big feelings. And it's like that doesn't go away entirely. It's like it's just new challenges and new stressors and new all of these things. But there's also so much beauty to be found. And one thing that I've kind of found as a pet peeve, that's why I'm setting all of this up to ask this question, is in our culture in general, is there is this really pervasive attitude towards parenting, where so often we say to moms especially, but parents in general, but moms get the brunt of it, whatever stage of parenting they're in, whether it's a newborn, a toddler, a tween, a teen, it's like we say, well, just you wait. It's like this constant, just you wait. It's only, and like implied, like it's going to get worse. It's going to get harder. Or sometimes I hear the, oh, you know, just you wait, it's going to get better. But more often than not, I feel like we're in this, just you wait, it's going to get hard. Parenting teens is the worst. It's going to be miserable years. And that drives me crazy. And so I'm curious, like, Why do you think that is the case in our culture? Why have we created this attitude around parenting is miserable? Parenting teenagers and tweens is just brutal work. And you just have to like get through it. You have to survive until they're adults and they finally like you again. Why do you think that is the way it is?
Yeah, I can remember people saying, oh, little people, little problems, big people, big problems. And, you know, you just leave and you're carrying little people around and you're absolutely exhausted. And you're thinking, this feels like a big problem. I can't even imagine, you know, if you're telling me it's going to be harder. And I think the reality is, I think parenting is hard in every season. So let me just say that. I think there are struggles and joys in every season, but I actually just think that's life. You know, if we were to go back to college, we'd be like, my memory sometimes can be, oh, it was so fun. What a great time in life. And I forget the test. I forget the stress. I forget that there were really hard things in it. And so I think sometimes it's we get into parenting teens and all we remember are the cute little two-year-old hugs. And we forget what it was like to get a two-year-old dressed who didn't want to get dressed and who's kicking you and throwing a complete meltdown. And we just forget. We are forgetful. We tend to remember, look back with fondness and forget the hard things of whatever season we might have exited. So I think there's that. But I also think there is this narrative in culture that says, oh, teenagers are awful to be around. And, you know, they don't want their parents' involvement. And they kind of almost demonize teens. And it's just been really interesting to me. I loved teaching teens. I loved being a high school teacher. And I loved my own teens. I still have one teenager. I still have one 17-year-old. And I think it's just been a really fun season. But part of it, I would say, is allowing them to grow up and seeing them as full humans, but yet not quite adults, and being patient with who they are and where they are developmentally. So I think we can be really impatient that they're not acting like an adult. And then at the same time, we don't allow them freedom and responsibility. So we're, you know, there's this battle going on in some sense, and we are right as parents to give good boundaries. Like that's a good thing to do. But at the same time, if I'm parenting my 12-year-old, like I did my 2-year-old, that's a parenting problem. That's actually not their fault. You know, it's one thing to tell your 2-year-old something and have expectations. But as our children age, it's not that the principles of our parenting changes, but our practice of parenting has to change. It has to shift because we're trying to prepare them to make decisions on their own. And they're actually able to understand things in a really different way. And so I would say, and what I've tried to get at in this book is these can be really great years, but we have to, at some point, die to ourselves in certain ways and our pride. You know, if a kid kind of speaks to us and maybe not the best attitude, maybe, you know, there's going to be bad attitudes. There are going to be slam doors. There are going to be days when they don't want to be around anyone. I'm like that sometimes, right? And I'm almost 50 and I still struggle to control my emotions sometimes. So can't we be gracious with a 13-year-old who also might be struggling to control their emotions along the way? And so I think that helps us to kind of parent with a little more hope when we realize this is a stage they're going through. How can I shepherd them well through it and be kind of a soft place for them to be able to have a bad day? And I think that changes how we walk through this season with them. And I think we can do it with a lot of hope and a lot of joy and a lot of enjoyment. But, you know, it takes some soul work on our part to be able to do that.
Yeah, it does. Well, one of the things I know you talk about in your book that just something you said just here is what kind of sparked this question is the difference between a gracious home and a permissive home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially when we talk about like giving our kids space to grow up, space to make mistakes. And, you know, in fact, I had a conversation with my daughter recently about this, about how she was like, Mom, I feel like you don't want me to grow up. And I was like, no, that's not it, honey. You know, and in some ways, like it's finding the balance of she wants to grow up faster than she actually is growing up. And so I'm trying to help her and walk with her growing as she grows up, but in an age appropriate way, if that makes sense, you know, rather than like shoving her into maybe an age stage that she's not actually in yet, if that makes sense. And so I guess that idea of a gracious home versus a permissive home, in which you do set boundaries, you do allow your kids to make mistakes, but you're also not letting your kids parent you, or like your kids aren't dictating and running the household, which is an interesting balance to strike. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about those differences.
Yes. I think the reality is you can only be gracious in a home where there actually are rules, because right. The reality is that we're gracious because mistakes get made. So there have to actually be standards in some ways to say, hey, I know that curfew was at this time and you were late. And let's talk about what happened. Let's work through why that happened. Why didn't you text me? Why didn't you let me know? Or, you know, you can have those real conversations. Right. But a permissive home is actually proven to have bad outcomes for kids. We think we're, you know, being the great parent because we are letting them do whatever they want to do. Oh, if you want to be on your cell phone, if you want to be out till 2 a.m., that, you know, oh, I'm just being a nice parent. It's actually, proven that that's not good for kids. And they actually don't feel safe being in control of their own universe. They need boundaries. It's good for them to have boundaries. It's not good for them to have boundaries that are so restrictive that they can't learn to make some decisions on their own. Yeah, so it really is a dance as our kids age. You know, I describe it in the book like when you learn to drive a stick shift. You have to know just how much to press on the gas and press on the clutch at the same time, but you might stall sometimes. Yeah. It's a tough thing to do. And the same as giving our parent or giving our kids some space to make mistakes, but we want them to be like mistakes, maybe like, hey, you got a zero on that assignment because you didn't do it, you know, but I'm not going to do your homework for you. I'm not going to do that. Well, that's different than making the mistake of drinking and driving, right? That's going to have a lot bigger consequences. So we want to make sure we're putting boundaries that prevent certain types of behaviors as much as we can, as much as in our power to help them with. But sometimes I think it's okay to say, yeah, I'm not going to check up on all your homework assignments, and I'm going to let you bear the consequences of those failures. And that can still be gracious to them, you know, to let them experience that, which is different than being permissive and letting them do whatever they want to do.
Oh, absolutely. I actually love the image that you shared of driving a stick shift, because I drive a stick shift, love driving a stick shift. And I remember those early days of when my parents were teaching me how to drive a stick. And in fact, like the pro tip my dad taught me, because he had let me just kind of jerk forward and stall out a bunch of times. But one of the things that he had taught me, and he's like, there's a little trick. And he was like, actually, you know, put your foot on the brake, put your foot on the clutch, and then take your foot off the brake and slowly take your foot off the clutch. As you feel the car start to move forward on its own, if you take too much off, the car will stall out. But if you slowly remove your foot off the clutch and you slowly put your foot on the gas as the car is starting to move forward on its own, that gives you that feeling of that push and pull. And I actually think that's a beautiful image of like, if you take your foot off if you remove the boundaries way, way, way too fast, and then all of a sudden, like you're gonna, you know, you're going to stall out and you're going to jerk forward and it's going to be really painful. But as you slowly start to remove some of those kind of parameters around your kids and slowly let them out into the world a little bit further, the goal is obviously that you release, you know, fully capable human beings into the world, rather than just like opening the front door and shoving them out and being like, all right, good luck. We'll see ya.
Exactly. Exactly. They're going to feel just as lost in that, you know, and I don't know if you felt this way as a teacher. I can remember there were certain teachers who had no rules.
Yeah.
And the kids didn't like those classes. I can remember one student coming to me and saying that teacher doesn't care about us. She never gives us homework. She doesn't care if we learn. She just lets us run, you know, the classroom, you know, whatever. But I can tell she doesn't actually care about us. And I think that's the problem of a permissive home. It's actually saying, I'm not really that worried about you. In some sense, just do whatever you want. Well, that's just not great for kids. Whereas a home with appropriate boundaries is saying, hey, I really care about you. I want to help you get through this life. I want you to be able to drive on your own, but I'm here to help until you can do that.
I want to take a quick break from my chat with Melissa to let you know that my new book, If I Don't Laugh, I'll Cry, How Death, Debt, and Comedy Led to a Life of Faith, Farming, and Forgetting What I Came Into This Room For, is now available wherever books are sold. You can buy it anywhere online. It's in multiple formats, paperback, audiobook, and yes, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably already enjoy the sound of my voice. So if you want me to read my book to you, I can do that via audiobook or Kindle e-reader, wherever you get books. I would love for you to pick up a copy, and I would love for you to take a moment to leave a review of it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Goodreads, wherever you review books. It would mean so much to me if you would take just a moment to do that. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your support and for letting me know how this book is impacting you. Keep sharing it, because man, I'm telling you, something amazing is happening. Now back to my chat with Melissa Krueger.
One of the other things that you talk about is as kids are transitioning, and this has been admittedly, like raising my hand, something that has been hard for me in my parenting is, you know, it of course makes sense that our kids transition into new stages of life. Of course, the newborn stage is different than the toddler stage. And of course, the toddler stage is different than the pre-K age and the pre-K age from the elementary age and middle school and high school and young adult. Like, of course, we know that. That makes sense. But the reality is we as parents also have to change as well. We can't parent our kids. And of course, not like in a literal sense, like we can't treat our high schoolers like newborns, but we can't parent and have the same mindset and even see our kids the same way when they're in high school as we did when they were toddlers. I liked what you said about seeing them as, you know, whole independent human beings. That's so important. And I think like, that's actually something in my adulthood I've had to shift my on how I viewed my parents. Because, you know, my dad, he's going to be 80 this year. And it really wasn't until the last couple of years that I was like, I came to a full, complete understanding of like, oh yeah, my dad, when he was parenting me, like he was a whole independent human being who had a whole life before I came along. And his life wasn't just like centered around being my dad. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard for us as kids to transition that in our brain. But then on the flip side, as a parent, it's also hard to transition that as you start to see your kids. And I would be interested for you parenting young adults, like where they're really like, they're no longer under your quote unquote, like control. You're, you know, not that you're controlling your kids, but like, they're no longer under your influence like they once were. They are now independent human beings who can live their own lives, create their own lives, make their own lives. And so it's important for you to shift those mindsets. So I'd love for you to touch on that, about what that process looks like as for parents to change and adapt as their kids also change and go from season to season.
Yes. I think when I think about those transitions, look, I mean, we need to be praying in the little years, but as we are making those transitions into the older years with our kids, I think what we've all learned, when I've looked around with my friends, we've all been like, all we can do is pray. You know, I have one friend right now whose son is in ranger school. And I mean, basically he's being starved and, you know, made to run and do push-ups and all these hard, awful things. And she doesn't hear from him for weeks at a time while he's in ranger school. And it's like, all you can do is pray. And so there are these things we're watching our kids walk through that we can't solve. We can't make better. We can't just put a Band-Aid on it and kiss it and make it go away. And so part of the transition that has to actually start in the younger years, we should be doing this in the younger years, but I think we believe we have a little bit of a measure of control in the young years because we're there with them every moment. We're a lot more active in the day-to-day of their lives. But as our kids are older and we start to really walk alongside them and we have to say, hey, I'm here for you, but I can't solve the issues. I can't, you know, change things. And, but I think we can show them the path to how do I walk with God, whatever may come? How am I a prayerful person? How am I a person who lives my life in light of what the Bible teaches and different things like that? We can model it. We can walk alongside them. We can't make them do those things. We can't make them really believe anything. We start to find out as they get to these ages. And so I think part of the transition is just seeing them as an independent human being. So when they have questions about the rules we have, or even the faith we have, or things like that, I think really just being curious with a teenager is a great way to start and say, hey, tell me what you're feeling about that. Why don't you like the fact that I'm only getting you a dumb phone rather than a smartphone. Tell me why that upsets you so much. What's it about? Because for different kids, it's going to be a different reason. And so part of, I think, growing up with our teen in some ways is remaining curious about who they are and not making assumptions about why they're pushing back on something. Just like I would be curious with my friend who maybe has a different opinion than me. I would say, hey, why do you think that? And so I think there's a level of that that we can bring to the parenting our teen conversation that's sometimes forgotten because as parents, we just want to control our teen rather than help understand who they are and get to know them as a person. And so I think there's a lot of things we can do as parents to really engage with them that's very different than we did with maybe a two-year-old. But part of that can only happen when we as parents can let go of our child being a representative of ourselves. And I think it's really tempting as a parent sometimes to place a lot of our identity in our teen. And so whether it's the sports they play, the college they get into, whatever, that becomes about us and not about them. And that's, I think, when we fall into some pits as parents, because we start trying to control who they become rather than walk alongside them as they're becoming who God made them to be.
Okay. I love this so much. Because this is a conversation I have had very recently with quite a few people about how, and I think that, you know, there's nuance in all of that. So I feel like I have, in all of this. So I feel like I have to make that disclaimer because this is not, I'm painting with a broad brush here. But one thing that we see so much is when a kid, at really any age, but especially teenagers, tweens, things like that, when a kid like misbehaves or mess up, we often immediately, as a culture and online, the internet warriors immediately place blame on the parents, like immediately. And I'm not saying, again, nuance, I'm not saying that this is every case, because certainly there are cases where it is clearly a reflection of some things that have happened at home. But we see where it's like, oh, well, what, you know, kid says something, and it's like, oh, well, we know what's being said at home. Or kid does something, oh, well, we know that they're just doing what was modeled at home. And I'm like, you can get out of here with that. Because like my kids for sure have said things before where I'm like, excuse me, where did you hear that? And like, they heard it on the bus. They heard other kids say it on the bus. And so I'm like, you didn't hear that from me. You didn't hear that word from me. Like my 8-year-old son came home one day and was and repeated an expletive that he heard on the bus. And I was like, whoa, you know, and he's like, well, this kid said it. And I was like, oh, heavens to Betsy. Like, I just, you know, I was not prepared at all. He's a whole independent human being who like heard something and then he's repeating it. So like, but he didn't hear it at home. And so I do think that there is this problem where we immediately often jump to placing blame, quote unquote, on kids for like, or placing the blame on parents for what kids behavior rather than looking at it from a, no, these are entirely independent human beings who have sinful natures at heart, who are going to make mistakes. And like stuff happens. Like I had incredible parents and I made some wildly irresponsible and stupid choices as a kid because I was a selfish, broken teenager. But on the flip side, like you were saying, is then we often as parents then place our own identities in our kids' behavior as like if they are misbehaving, then it is immediately a reflection on us. We must be the worst. We must have parented them incorrectly. And I think the fault really falls on both ourselves and also like cultural norms, cultural expectations as a whole is like we've done this to ourselves as a culture and then we just continue the crazy cycle as parents. And I mean, would you agree with that sentiment or would you disagree?
Yeah, I think any parent, whenever our kid hits a snag, unfortunately, my first response is, what did I do wrong? I mean, look, it's so funny. Like my kids, actually none of them have really dated in high school. And I'm sitting there like, oh, why aren't my kids dating? Do they not think we have a good marriage? Yeah, or whatever, like no matter what they're doing. But if they were all dating, I'd be thinking, oh, did you not get enough love at home? So you feel like the need to always have a boyfriend or girlfriend? You know, like we always think whatever they're doing is about us. And I've had to really step back and say, huh, maybe the world doesn't revolve around me. Maybe. It just is sometimes, whatever it might be on these things. And when my kid makes a mistake, I think most, when any of our teens make a mistake, I think most of us jump really quickly to what did I do wrong rather than how can I come alongside my teen in this moment and help them? And I think that's the more helpful response at that moment to say, this isn't about me. It's really about how am I going to help this teen in this moment? And what does it mean to show up for them as the mature adult in the room? Because I think so often we go into an emotional tailspin, which actually isn't helping our teenager at all. They need us to be fully present, fully able to be the adult in the room. And it's normal that they're going to make mistakes. I mean, that's a part of growing up. And so the thing we have to show them and model for them is, hey, what do we do when we make mistakes? How do we walk through these things? What does it look like to say, hey, I'm sorry? What does it look like to, if you break something, pay back what you broke or whatever it might be. And helping our kids learn how to work through failure, learning how to make a mistake is actually a life lesson. How do you make a mistake? And then what do you do? And how do you walk through it? And we can really do that, but we can't do that if we're always making their situations about us. It's not healthy for our kid and it's not healthy for us either.
So like I mentioned at the beginning, love story. I know that you were a teenager once and you probably made some mistakes. Do you have a particular story maybe that involves a garage door? That you would like to share?
Yes. Oh my gosh. It was so bad. I was rushing out of the door because I was late to getting to work. And so in my rush, I turned the car on and backed up and immediately heard the crash. And I had forgotten to open the garage door when I was backing up in my hurry. And, you know, I have to say, my mom heard the crash and came outside. She saw it and she immediately, I don't know how she had the wherewithal to do this so fast. She immediately said, take my car. I know you're late for work. Go on to work. She said, don't worry. I'll handle it. And it was just this picture of, it's okay. I know what's needed right now. You need to get to work and take my car. And then by the time I got home, I walk in and my dad just looks at me. He's like, girl, what on earth were you thinking? But he never yelled at me. He never got mad at me. They knew it was a mistake and they covered it so beautifully, you know, and I look back on that. And even when I was writing that story in the book, I was tearing up just thinking about it. How many people would have a very different story and the impact that that would make? If I had been yelled at, if I had been belittled, if I had been told, you know, that was the stupidest thing. You know, you can just imagine all the things that I was saying to myself. What was I thinking? You know, I mean, I said all of those things. And yet my parents just met me with a lot of grace. And I'll be honest, it was one of those things that really transformed me in a lot of ways, but also transformed how I parented. I remembered that story as I entered into parenting. And I always wanted to be the parent who was gracious with failure when my kids failed. I wanted my kids to feel like it was okay to make mistakes in this house and that I was going to be there for them if they did.
I love that story so much. That was why I wanted you to tell it because it really is. I'll be honest, like it was a story that I really made me think about, okay, how do I navigate this with my kids? I mean, my kids aren't driving yet. Lord help me when they do.
But I will tell you, that's my least favorite moment of parenting is when I have to get in the car with a 15-year-old and you feel like this is not okay. Nothing about this feels safe or okay.
Nothing about it. I when I read that story, I just immediately was like, man, that is the kind of parent that I want to be. And I've certainly had moments where, you know, cause my kids at 8 and 10, like, and you know, and younger, like they've made mistakes where I have certainly not handled it the way I should have, where I have been like, how could you know this? Like, you know, I mean, definitely, I've definitely done that. But I've tried to give myself grace in that and also like do it in a way and handle situations in a way when I can and when I have the presence of mind to like, okay, how can I do this well? I mean, I had an instance probably over a year ago, gosh, maybe 2 years ago, where one of my children was throwing a ball in the house. I told this child, please don't throw the ball in the house. And next thing I know, the ball crashes into a picture frame of my dog that I had just put down. And aww, it like knocked the picture frame off the mantle, shattered everywhere. And then there's, you know, there's glass everywhere. There's just like the, all of it. And I just, and immediately my child was like, oh my gosh, 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 I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I mean, just like immediately knew. And I, you know, my gut was like, this is why I told you not to throw the freaking ball in the house, you know? And like, but then at the same time, like I immediately saw the like fear and almost remorse in the face of my child. And I just like came at it with compassion. And I was like, it's okay. Like it happens. You're going to buy me a new picture frame, but also don't throw the ball in the house again. And I just, you know, we just hugged for an extended period of time and it ended up being actually a really sweet moment between us. And I don't get that right all the time, but I, you know, I think about as the life stages of my children grow and change, and there will be bigger things like garage doors, you know, maybe, or whatever. How do I handle that in a God-honoring, loving way while also like, you know, picking it, like there might be times where like there's some accountability that needs to happen here, you know, in addition to the grace and really inviting the Holy Spirit into that discussion and all of that. Well, I want to transition a little bit because of that. And that is to really this faith-filled piece. And obviously this is a huge part of your book. Your Heart for Parenting Teens is helping them navigate also their faith, in a world that is increasingly drawing teens away from the faith. And so that can be really, really hard to navigate. That's a whole nother, you know, aspect of this. And so, you know, there's sort of two camps here. There's the camps of kids who are raised in really like just amazing, strong Christian homes, but still struggle and like they leave the faith. And so you have parents who are just like, I did everything right I think I did everything right. And then you also have the kids who are really like, they're not leaving the faith, but they are just deeply wrestling. They don't know how to handle the peer pressure, the just cultural things, all of it. I wanted to touch on this because this obviously is an incredibly important aspect of all of it. So I'd love for you to kind of help guide us as parents in general and anybody who's listening who even just has influence in a child's life. So even if you're listening, you don't have kids, but you work with young adults, you work with teenagers, you're a teacher, maybe you're a coach of some kind, you know, you have influence in the lives of children, whether you realize it or not. And so maybe you're the fun aunt or the funcle, you know, their fun uncle, whatever, you know. So how do you help them navigate their faith in a world that is increasingly, you know, attacking our kids in a lot of ways?
Yeah. Well, and let me just speak for a second to people who maybe don't have teens or don't have kids. And I love what you just said about including them, because sometimes you're better at it than the parent, meaning in the teen's life. So that person, that coach or that cool 20 something at church, that your teen seeing that person in church, being a person of faith can have such an impact. I hope people don't discount that because it's so important. I prayed for all my kids, Lord, please give them mentors, because there may be a day they don't want to talk to me about faith right. matters or things. And so will you give them that cool 20-something-year-old who loves you and can speak truth when maybe they don't want to hear it from me? Because, you know, it's pretty normal for them to go through a period where they're like, yeah, I mean, I've heard enough of you for the past 16 years. But I would just say, one of the best ways we can share our faith, the first way we share our faith with our teens is by actually participating in a regular basis ourselves and growing in our own faith. I think teens can spot a fake more than anybody else. And so if our Christianity is simply surface level, to kind of look good, kind of outward, but not inward, our teens are going to understand that. And they see what's happening in our home every day. They really see what we truly value, and which is kind of terrifying. But the reality for us, what it means is what we press into is not being perfect. We press into abiding in God ourselves, being a person who is trying to grow in their faith. Again, that doesn't mean we're perfect, but we're pursuing knowing God. And I think that really speaks to our kids. We're not saying, I know everything about God. We say, I'm a person of faith and I am trying to get to know God better. Will you come alongside me and try to get to know him better too? And that's really different than presenting myself as the expert. When my kid has questions about faith, I can be like, that's a really good question. Let's investigate that together. Rather than, I think sometimes as parents, we feel like we have to have all the answers. And if we don't, somehow our kid is, that means they're going to go, you know, fully down other paths and they're not going to believe. And so I think there's something really powerful that we discount how powerful it is just to be a person who is walking with Jesus ourselves and abiding in his word and being a prayerful person and praying with our teen. We have a epidemic of teen anxiety and depression right now, and they're real. And there are a lot of ways, yeah, a lot of things going on with that, with social media and all the things that our kids are facing right now. And it can feel overwhelming. But one thing I did in the research for the book was kids who go to church services once a week have an 18% higher degree of happiness later in their youth. And so there are some things that we're just doing as habits of the Christian life that can really help kids. That doesn't mean that all kids in youth group will never struggle with anxiety or depression. They will. But the small things we're doing as people of faith can really help them in this journey and all the struggles that they're facing in our society today. So we're trying to set before them, hey, here's an example of what it means to walk with God. The world's going to tell you it doesn't matter. The world's going to be shouting at you that, you know, choosing all these other things is way better. But I think what we have to offer is, you know, so much richer and so much better. And so it's key as we continue to put that before the kids and show them, hey, this is life. And this really is life abundant. And those other paths, I mean, and look, I mean, if you just go down a list of songs out there that talk about like how unsatisfying life is and how unsatisfying fame is, I did a recent study on it. Every decade had a song like "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," or, you know, basically every different generation had some song that expressed, no matter what I get out of this life, it's not quite enough. And so I think one way we help our teen is actually wrestling with, what do you think is going to give you life? And do you really think that path that someone out there is telling you is going to give it to you? It's really not going to. And having good and healthy conversations with them can be just part of that discussion of faith in the home that involves listening, and it involves sharing with them our own experience in a lot of ways.
I love how you touch on that modeling aspect of it and showing them, like, just, you know, it's a, so often, especially with teens, like you said, like they've spot a phony and the, from a mile away, and the importance of showing, not just telling, like, not the do as I say, but not as I do, but actually in this case, like, do as I do and not as I say, or something. I don't know. I've probably completely butchered that, but you know what I'm saying is, like, this idea of, like, we have to get to this point where we are modeling these behaviors in our own lives, and then it becomes a reflection, you know. And so it's been interesting for us as a family. We have been involved with a church plant for about almost 2.5 years now. And, you know, every single Sunday morning, like, my husband drives the trailer. We're a set up and tear down church. And every single Sunday morning, my husband, like, drives the trailer from our house to the high school where we set up, you know, and we're there every Sunday from 7:30 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. And our kids are with us the whole time. And, but what's been really interesting to see is our kids actually, so I usually drive separate. I mean, my husband and I get there around the same time, but he's always leaving a little bit before me because the truck drives slower with the trailer. And my kids almost always clamor to ride with him and get there first. And that's been actually really cool to see, like, that they don't dread going to church on Sunday mornings, and, like, they know that it's going to be a long day, but yet they're still excited. But I think it's because they also see that, like, this is all of us together are doing this. Like, we're not, you know, my husband plays in the worship team. He plays, you know, multiple instruments. I sing and I play guitar. I preach occasionally. My husband preaches occasionally. My 10-year-old daughter is now actually serving in the children's program. And so she's helping with the toddlers. And so it's like, we're modeling this, like, we're all in this together. And my prayer has been that this is the kind of thing that lasts with them, and they see the longevity of this, and that this wasn't just a season, but something that we really believed in and that became theirs too, like giving them some ownership. And so that's been really key. So just what you said just really encouraged me in my own, like, because sometimes, like, I can look at my husband and be like, are they just going to be totally burnt out and be done and, like, just hate this? And I don't, and, like, they're going to resent us for this. Like, it's a fear of mine. And so I have to actively pray against that.
Yeah. It was a fear of mine as well. I mean, yeah, my husband was a pastor. Yeah, I'm like, oh, we're going to be those people. I really had the same fear that it was just too much, you know, a little bit, like, they're going to think, wow. But you know what? I just discounted what a blessing it could be for them. My kids actually know what a good friend is. Like, it's just been fascinating to watch how growing up in a home where they went to church every week and they knew how to pray with one another and they knew how to give a good apology because we all messed up and we all had to tell each other we were sorry all the time. What a rich blessing that's been. They have great friendships. Like, my daughter's getting married this summer. I love who she's marrying. You know, she's marrying this great guy. And I've just watched the rich blessings of growing up in the church. It doesn't mean there haven't been hard things. There have been, we all make mistakes. So Christians make mistakes too. And they've experienced that. And that's painful in its own way. But I can definitely say, having something bigger than themselves has been this anchor for them. I don't see them questioning, like, why am I here? what's life about. They're like, oh, I'm here because God made me and he created me to glorify him. And so, you know, a lot of kids in a secular age are struggling with that very question. My son, his freshman year of college, there were 7 suicides at his college. And, you know, I think the reality is like, it's so tough in a world where you don't know what your purpose is and you've never been told that. We sometimes think of religion as restrictive. I actually think it's life-giving. What's restrictive is to kind of think, wow, am I just a bag of molecules that doesn't really matter? It's a pretty hopeless world without God. It's a pretty hopeless existence without Christ. And so I think what I've really come to find is that my kids, the faith that they've gotten to see lived out through the church has really just made them a lot more joyful. And they've all, as they've gone up to college, they've all found good churches. And I've been so thankful to see that. And those churches, like my daughter was in college during COVID, and when she and her roommates all got COVID, the church came and brought them meals and things like that. So they've gotten to experience these rich blessings that I don't think I could see even when they were 2. I just felt like, wow, this is really tough to take my 2-year-old to church. But it was so, when I look back, it's been so worth it to see the effect it's had on them.
That's such an encouragement to somebody who's just like in a parenting season right behind you, bringing up the caboose. but to hear that. So thank you for sharing that. Well, I could talk to you forever, but we're running out of time. So I guess my last question before we go is around the habit of prayer as a family, cultivating a heart of prayer, helping our kids know how to pray and creating a healthy prayer life in their own lives. Because this is something admittedly that I have struggled with. I've worked on it a lot and I've come a long way, but it's an area that of growth for us for sure. And so I would love for you to kind of share maybe some advice or tips or anything like that has worked well for you in your family and in your parenting to cultivate a habit of prayer in your parenting and in your family.
Yeah. We actually pray every morning around the breakfast table. That was kind of our habit. And that sounds like, how on earth did that happen? What I will say is this, my biggest parenting rule that I used to tell myself is my kids only know the home they're growing up in. So look, every one of us convinces our kids to brush their teeth every day, you know, and they just think that's normal. And it is normal. Hopefully it's normal, you know, for all of us. And so the reality is we just started at the family breakfast table. We all would get down there. They all knew what time they needed to be down there. And we would just have about 5 to 10 minutes of prayer every morning. And it wasn't a big thing. It wasn't perfect. It was, I always say, aim for patterns, not perfection. It doesn't have to be every single morning or whatever, but we had a card for each day. And on that card, it would have different prayer things, but every card had a different name from our family. And so like Monday might be Kate, Tuesday might be John, Wednesday, Emma, Thursday might be me, Friday might be my husband. And, but also on those cards were different things in our world that we were praying for. Maybe their principal, maybe a missionary that we support, maybe a friend who's going through a hard time. And we just had a card for each day. And so when it was Tuesday, we picked out Tuesday's card. Whoever the person was shared something they had that going on that week. Another person prayed for them and prayed for the card. It was that simple. It was not hard. And yet what I can say is those 5 to 10 minutes at the breakfast table every morning formed a community with our kids that is so tight. And we laughed at the breakfast table so much. Those little moments of connection make such a big difference. And so we had that. That was our scheduled time of prayer, but that gave us the freedom to just pray at other times when things were going on and it didn't feel weird, if that makes sense. So, you know, simple things like, I'm worried someone might not ask me to prom. In that moment, I'd say, hey, let's just pray about it. Let's just pray. Let's ask God that someone would ask you to prom or whatever it might be that comes up in our kid's life. And so it almost having this scheduled time, again, that was like 5 to 10 minutes. We spend that much time on social media every day, easy. It wasn't a long time, allowed for that habit to be a normal muscle in our home. So then when other things were going on, we would just have random prayers. And I can say it was one of those, just it connected us to each other and also connected us to God. And it allowed kids to learn, how do I deal with the hard things of life? Well, if I don't know what to do, I can pray. And so as we're developing that muscle, they're developing that muscle, and it's something that we can do together.
I think that is so helpful. I love that. And so that, I hope that that really helps somebody else that's listening that might be struggling in this area, just keeping it simple. And I also love that too, patterns over perfection. That is so good. That's just like a life hack right there. Well, Melissa, as we are wrapping up here, where can people best connect with you? Tell them where to get the book, all the things.
Yeah, you can find out anything you want to at my website, melissabkruger.com. You can find the book anywhere, you know, all the places that it's so easy to get books now. And I write for the Gospel Coalition, so you can find articles and things by me there. So all of those places, they'll be links.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You are such a gift. And thanks for your wisdom and for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been so fun.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you loved it. I would love to know what you learned, or if there was something that inspired you or encouraged you, please let us know on social media. You can find me at Still Being Molly or at Can I Laugh Pod on the socials. And would you take a moment to head on over and subscribe and leave a review and all of those things? It really does help us to know what you're liking and how the show's impacting you. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. And of course, as always, thank you to the team at Third Wheel Media for producing the show. And for you, I hope something this week makes you laugh till you cry. We'll see you next week. Bye.